From the Roots Up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
Hello and welcome. It's the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. And we're going to be talking soon, we hope, with the author of a really important book, which is going to tell us an important story having to do with the how we got into our scandal over the Canadian Parliament of cheering for a SS member, you will recall. I want to remind everybody that Tamara Lorenz is speaking tomorrow, Tuesday, October the 22nd at 7 p.m., 51 Adair in Hamilton. And also that Tony Leah, the author of The Truth About the 37 Oshawa GM Strike, will be speaking at a different book list on October 30 at 7 p.m. And there'll be more news about that. And later in the show, by the way, we'll be talking to Jacob Leibovich of the Steelworkers about their participation in the demonstration around Gaza, which happened yesterday in the city. But I believe we're joined by Peter McFarlane. Are you there, sir?
I am, yes.
Hey, thanks very much for talking to us. This is a terrific book. It's titled Family Ties, How a Ukrainian Nazi and a Living Witness Link Canada to Ukraine Today. This is a very timely book, but I got to say that Canadians have had a lot of trouble understanding this story of our Deputy Prime Minister, Chrystia Freeland, and where she had been confronted by, well, not confronted, asked a question by journalists about her grandfather, whom she had always praised and said was an inspiration to her. And they asked her if it was true that he had been a Nazi collaborator. And she gave a mysterious answer saying, well, you know, we have to pay attention to the danger of Russian disinformation. And then the story sort of sank. Sometime a year, I don't know how many years it's been, but a year or so later, the entire Canadian Parliament stood up and applauded when the Speaker of the House said that they had a wonderful gentleman in the gallery who had fought the Russians. And, of course, applauding was, among them, was Chrystia Freeland. And then the day after, we're told, well, actually, he was in the SS. We keep having these, I call it a Dr. Strangelove moment. And your book, Family Ties, you decided at some point, I guess you had been writing about Ukraine, traveled there, to look into the story of the Shomiak family, if I got it right. This is a long preface, but I got to tell you, I'm very impressed with the book and still digesting what I have read. But tell me where you came in, where you decided to, maybe this is something you should look into.
Yeah, as you mentioned, I was in Ukraine, at least going back and forth, traveling. I was researching another book on, it was actually on the Ukraine mafia in the eastern part of the country, that had stolen a grain business, a $28 million grain business from a Canadian businessman. And so while I was there, the story, I guess, broke about the Chomiak family, that, as you mentioned, your reporters, I think it was in back in 2017, or 2017 or 2019, that the story originally broke. It was Ottawa journalist, Ottawa citizen journalist who wrote the story. And so I was there, and I was also met one of her relatives there because he was a big shot in the grain business. Jomiak, it's her uncle. He was born in Canada, but when the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991, he traveled back there with some U.S. aid money and set up a grain exchange there. So I knew something about the family, and I was kind of intrigued about this story where she had kind of denied that her grandfather had been a Nazi collaborator, and yet the evidence was very strong. So what I did is I contacted, I found family members there using Facebook, and I contacted them, and that's where the story kind of started. I spoke to them. They were very forthcoming, and they gave me lots of printed information and stuff that I could digest, and that's how the story then started to unravel about the real story about her grandfather and Michael Chomiak. So I was on the scene, and at the same time, I should mention, because it's family ties, a good friend of mine, a writer, Anne Charney, she had written a remarkable book in the 1970s called Dobrid, which is an anagram for Brody, the town. She spent 2 years with her mother hiding in the barn. She's a Jewish refugee, and then spent several years trying to get to Canada. So it was family ties. It was two stories, the stories of the Jewish refugee from Ukraine and the Nazi collaborators, the SS people that came in by the thousands in 1948 to 1950
into
Canada.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's I think it's a great, I'm going to say, as a strategy, how to tell that story. It was speaking with Anne Charney, and thank you, by the way, for calling attention to. Apparently, I now will read that novel. I was unaware of the novel. Dobrid, I guess, is how you pronounce it. And which is stands in for the Ukrainian community called Brody.
That's right.
On this matter of where the Canadian public picked it up, the strangeness is that there has been a odd way of dealing with it. The media has said, well, it's her grandfather, Mr. Chomiak. And she isn't. She really doesn't have to talk about him, because, well, you know, people are not responsible for their grandparents. But the way that she went about answering told us more about the failure of media to care about this story. It struck me because, as you point out in the book, she had actually kind of promoted herself as very proud of this grandfather. And when the information came out, she will neither affirm nor she won't say, and yeah. She's left us with a big question mark. And you seem to have definitely answered it, in my opinion. And so let's talk about who was her grandfather, Michael. I guess he used the name Michael here. He had been Mikhailo's.
Mikhailo Chomiak, in the book, because the archives, and this is the interesting point, all the information about him, all of it, is contained in the Province of Alberta archives. It was donated by the family, so all the letters, all the information, the pictures of him sitting with the Nazi officers, et cetera, that are in the book, that was donated by the family, and they named it Mikhailo Chomiak Archive. So I used the name they gave for the archives, although he was known more as just Michael in Edmonton, obviously. Mm-hmm. So who he was, okay. He was born in 1905 in a little town, Stranyatin, about 20 kilometers from Lviv, the big capital of the Galician region. Again, you get into Ukrainian politics here. That part of Ukraine was part of Poland before the war, and the rest of Ukraine, of course, was part of the Ukrainian Socialist Republic, was part of the Soviet Union. So there was that division there. So he was part of that Western Ukraine entity known as Galicia, that was part of Poland. He went to law school. He became a lawyer. But he was not really interested in legal studies, I guess, because he switched to being a journalist to the newspaper in Lviv, one of the largest, called the Dido, the newspaper in Ukrainian. And when the war broke out, he was part of their nationalist group. They were part of the organization of Ukrainian nationalists. When the war broke out, his organization, the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, was already siding with the Germans. The head of it was living in Germany. That he was in Nazi Germany, and he was sending radio messages to his people to support the Nazi forces as they swept through Poland, because they would free Ukraine and they would get rid of the Poles, that sort of thing. And so when the war broke out, the Germans came into Lviv, into the outskirts of Lviv. He remained, and it was then in September 1939 that the Soviets moved in with a deal with the Germans and moved into that part. And so they took over Lviv and the rest of Galicia, while the Nazis had the rest of Poland. And so what he did, and the nationalists did, is they fled from the Soviet zone into the German zone in Krakow. Was the capital of the German government in Poland. So he made the decision to go on to the German side, right?
Yes.
Within weeks of the beginning of the war.
Yeah, you already underlined that. It's interesting. Her language in describing her grandfather, she said, well, when the Soviets invaded Ukraine, my grandfather and grandmother fled to escape that, but she doesn't say where they were going or what their employment was thereafter.
Yeah.
As you point out, it's the blanks in her story that really are loud. So describe that. Why did he leave and head west as the Germans were coming? Where did he go and who employed him?
Yeah, that's right. I was thinking, when he was fleeing west, the dividing line between the Soviet zone and the Nazi general government was the San River, which is about 70 kilometers west of Lviv. So the Ukrainian nationalists were fleeing over that border into the Nazi zone. But at the same time, across that river, tens of thousands of Polish Jews were struggling to get across into the Soviet zone. Because that was their own.
A little known fact.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so, and it's important to understand what was happening in that part of Europe, because often you hear from one point of view, the nationalists fleeing what they saw as persecution. Certainly, it would have been persecution from the Soviet side, since their organization was already affiliated with the Germans. But they don't mention that on the other side that the Polish Jews were fleeing in great numbers, trying to escape into the Soviet zone, so it's a complex situation, not a simple situation at all.
Mm-hmm.
When he arrived in Krakow, I think there was like 30,000-40,000 Ukrainian nationalists that fled into Krakow and to escape the Soviet side, and they were instantly given, a budget and that sort of thing. They had an organization, since they were officially affiliated with the Nazis. They had their own organization, and they proposed a Ukrainian language newspaper that would work with the Germans to spread propaganda, the German propaganda among the Ukrainians. And Mikhail Chomiak, as somebody who was an editor at the newspaper Dilo in Lviv, he was given the job. First he was hired as assistant editor and then as full editor, I guess, by March 1940. And he remained editor of that newspaper for 5 years. He even moved with him to Vienna at the end of the war, when the Soviets were coming through, moved to Poland. And so he was a pretty loyal employee of the German intelligence who were paying the state.
When I read your account of him, he's very interesting that the so-called Ukrainian nationalist organizations, by the way, I sometimes have trouble with that, because sometimes we appear to be talking about a region called Galicia, and other times we're talking about, as though we're talking about the entire territory called Ukraine. He kind of reminds me of the way Hannah Arendt talked about Eichmann, in that he had some advantages. He was fluent in German, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, he grew up, I guess, okay, it's a little more history. It's so complex in that area. Okay, Galicia, up until the First World War, from the late early 1800s, right, so after the First World War, was part of the Austrian-Hungarian Empire, right? So, but he was born in 1905 until, I guess, 1920. German was like the official language of this part of Ukraine, this Galician province, this western province. And then it switched to Poland after the war. So, yes, his German was perfect. He was when he was going to grade school, there was a picture of the Austrian-Hungarian emperor on the wall. He was part of that group, but they were Ukrainian minority in that, in that area.
And so he would have been, you know, I assume that, and let's say who is the, he was paid, literally paid by the, it's called the Abwehr, and
yes.
And and who are they? Who was the Abwehr? If you could talk about it.
Yeah, sure. That's the that was the German military intelligence, the Nazi Germany's military intelligence arm, and they paid for the newspaper. They paid his salary was quite good. I mean, his salary was up to like $45,000 a year equivalent, and for somebody. During the Second World War for Ukrainian, it was excellent. Well, super well paid, anyway. Yeah. And it was came from German military intelligence. And he worked very closely with the general government, the Nazi government in Krakow, and also with the Gestapo, who did oversight on the paper to make sure everything was correct from their point of view.
And he was given an apartment. Actually, he had a good one, and then he got a better one, I gather.
Right.
And they both these buildings had belonged to Jewish Polish owners, I believe.
That's right.
I should ask you, and that is true, right? I mean, because I recall this argument broke out. Well, you know, how deeply was he involved? And one of the stories that was shocking was that the man who owned the printing press where he put out his paper, a Nazi collaborating paper, had been a Jewish printer, and he got both the. They ended up with the print shop and the paper and the apartment.
That's right. Well, the newspaper, yes, it was a Jewish newspaper, and Polish language Jewish paper, and publisher had actually gone to the same law school as Chomiak, Jewish guy in Lviv, but he was running the newspaper in Krakow. And as soon as, of course, the Nazis came in, he had to flee, and he ended up getting killed in Belzec concentration camp. And the Germans and the Ukrainians took over his paper, and that's the paper that it became the Krakivsky Vesti,
and
the Krakow News, and that's what Michael Chomiak edited.
I'm so grateful for you for writing this and the details, because also you mentioned, and it is found in Chomiak's correspondence, that he wanted to be compensated for the cleaning he had to do in order to Aryanize the apartment.
That's right, yes. He used sort of it was kind of a major sort of Jewish lure in a letter he wrote to the city government in Krakow. It was the type of thing cleaning the. It was actually a doctor's apartment. His name was Finkelstein. But Chomiak, to get some extra money from them, suggested that the place was dirty and bugs and that sort of thing. That, of course, fit with the propaganda in his newspaper about Jewish people.
Yeah. We all, you know, part of the story we've heard, I mean, of Nazi ideology and propaganda was always the idea of vermin and of dirtiness.
Right. Exactly.
And in his own correspondence, he was sort of living, backing that up. I think it's very important to remind our listeners, by the way, we're speaking to Peter McFarlane. The book is called Family Ties. It's Lorimer. It's just out. This book is, it felt to me like I just finished it yesterday. You traveled there. You visited the Chomiak home. You've been to the birthplace, the little village, etc. But you also you visited a place called Brody.
Oh, yes.
And at the suggestion of Ann Charney, I believe.
That's right, yeah.
And because And I want to remind listeners, there's always denial. We've really reached a point where there's so much effort to downplay and to create stories of, well, it was just a misunderstanding, and you visited a museum in Brody where denial of what happened seems to be pretty explicit. Can you talk about that, visiting Brody?
Yeah, that was a real eye-opener, and it was very early on in my research, and I think this was really what propelled me forward. There's a small museum, as you mentioned, in Brody, that has maybe three rooms in it, three large rooms, actually. And one is sort of the prehistory, and the other is the history up till the 1900, and then the rest is the final room with the up to modern times. And mm-hmm. and when I walked into the third room, about 1900 on, what I saw first was German military helmet, a German machine gun sort of on the floor, and the pictures on the walls.
German helmet.
Yeah, and a machine gun, a famous German machine gun, I think it was mm-hmm. 42. And the pictures on the walls were of the, most of them on one wall were of the SS, the Galician SS, the Ukrainian SS. There was one with actually a photo with Himmler reviewing the Ukrainian SS. It was a famous famous day that he visited them, and he told them that that the Germans had cleaned up Galicia, the region, by killing all the Jews and that sort of thing. It was quite a famous moment in the SS history.
It was absolutely explicit. It was clear.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. 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 Exactly. And then the pictures of the SS guys in the uniform, the Ukrainian SS in training. There was a lot on the Battle of Brody. The Ukrainian SS was formed in 1943. They went into action in the summer of 1944, and they were in the Brody region. That's where they confronted the Soviets. The Soviets by that time were moving in from the east, and they had arrived at Galicia, and they were sent in to the battle. So it's a famous Battle of Brody. It was famous, too, because it practically wiped out the whole SS division, Ukrainian SS division. They were surrounded, and mm-hmm. only about, there were 15,000, I think, only less than 3,000 escaped. So there was a celebration of that war mm-hmm. in the museum as well, and the heroic of the Ukrainian SS soldiers. But what I noticed when I went through it, was that there was virtually nothing about the Jewish population of the town. And Brody, in the 1900s, and up till before the First World War, it had a majority of Jewish population, at one point 80% Jewish population. It was the center of Jewish culture in Eastern Europe. It was an amazing town with theaters and
mm-hmm. Yes, please go ahead.
For Jewish cultures. But even by 1939, when Anne was born there, 40% of the town was Jewish. There's 10,000 Jewish people. In the town, and the history of the museum, they were virtually not mentioned. So they were really the founders of the town, and there was 10,000 of them there.
You asked the director of the museum about that.
I did.
Incredible answer. Please go on.
Afterwards, yes. And what he said was, I said, I mentioned that you already have a large Jewish population. So yes, in the 19th century, it was 80% of the town. And he said, but in 1943, it was May 1943, the Germans came in and they wiped out the remaining the Jews. And so he made a gesture like sweep with his hands. And so they left the history, they left the history of the town because they were slaughtered, which is not really how history works. You know?
Yeah.
You can't.
You made it sound like they went away, they disappeared.
That's it. And also, it wasn't solely the Germans who murdered the Jews there. It was very much the nationalists, the Ukrainian nationalists and the EPA. And this information was very important to the book, was about how the mass murders caused by the organization of Ukrainian nationalists. And that information comes from a great historian, Jean-Paul Himka, who is, incidentally, is the uncle of Freeland, And in his early studies about her grandfather's newspaper and about the murderous history of the organization of Ukrainian nationalists, Freeland was actually cited as someone who reviewed the manuscript. So she knew all of this, and her that's what made her answer so dishonest, is that she knew the truth. She had seen her uncle's manuscript, had read it, had been consulted on it. So the trip to Brody, seeing how the Jews had just been dismissed from the history, that really made me want to search the story more. What's really going on here? How could this be? And about three or four years ago,
folks like Mr. Honka, who, by the way, seems to be just going on with his life, despite the fact that the Polish government, and we should mention, when Himmler and the others spoke about it, they wanted to eliminate Poles, Russians, and Jews. They said it clearly, and they without any Marcus of Queensbury, and they were going to do this. You have this. He belonged to the Galicia SS, and they have still markers and honored folks here. And a matter of fact, you can't in Ukraine. You can't even. I think you pointed out it's criminal to suggest that they were criminal. In other words, they're criminalized discussing criminals.
Exactly. That law was passed. I think it was in 2019. After the 2014, some call it a coup and some would call it a revolution, where the nationalists came to power in Ukraine. They had a historian, a very dodgy historian, was put in charge of decommunization, they call it. And a lot of that was just changing street names from sort of communist heroes from the past into organization of Ukrainian nationalist heroes, and many of them were actually Holocaust perpetrators. And so that people have obviously questioned that. But more serious than that, they passed a law that made it illegal, as you mentioned, illegal to criticize the organization of the Ukrainian nationalists or they had a military wing, Ukrainian Insurgent Army, which was a part of the OUN, basically. Mm-hmm. And so it became actually a crime to criticize them. The historians from around the world sent an open letter and denounced this, but it went through, and it exists today.
It's law.
Yeah.
You know, you had it's always in the book, there are really intriguing details. You point out that 40,000 Ukrainian Canadians served in the war against Hitler. And they're not memorialized, but the Galicia SS is honored.
Yeah, and that's a good point. You mentioned earlier that
now that's doing a backflip with mentally. Yeah. I can't begin. I do feel like saying, as I often mention lately, that we seem to be losing World War II. How could this be? Why isn't there a monument to the 40,000 who fought against Hitler instead of this outfit that served him?
It's very true, and it speaks about, I guess, what happened immediately after the Second World War, when the Ukrainian nationalists that were in Canada worked with others to bring the SS people into Canada. I think there was 2,000 plus their families, plus there was thousands of other collaborators that came to Canada, Nazi collaborators, and what happened to them immediately is they were used in the Cold War. It was by 1946, Canada was moving. There was the Gromyko affair and that sort of thing. Canada was moving to one of the leaders in the sort of the Cold War propaganda. And so the Ukrainian Nazi supporters, they quickly became rebranded as anti-Soviet fighters. And so they became instantly, they were portrayed as heroes. This was something, of course, Anne was here in Canada. She came, I think, in 1951. Her family finally made it here with her mother. And her mother, who had survived in the barn hiding from the Nazis and the Ukrainian nationalists, I think she weighed 75 pounds when she was rescued by the Red Army. She could not believe it, because she would see these people who she knew were Nazi collaborators, who were well-known, some of the leading Nazi collaborators of Ukraine were in, came to Canada, and they were being celebrated, and they were giving talks and that sort of thing. And for her, she could never understand it again, as Anne said, that why they preferred Nazis to Jews in Canada. That was the feeling that she had when she saw the elevation of the collaborators as Cold War, as anti-Soviet fighters.
Yeah, you very poignantly tell the story that and Charney and her mother, and her mother and aunt, by the way, come across really remarkable women, and they had to scratch and fight and be half-starved and go through all kinds of pain and travail in order to become Canadians. And the SS Galicia guys came in, and they were like, welcome to Canada. We're going to, you know, use you. They went from SS to assets.
Assets. It's exactly what happened.
I mean,
yeah.
Real pain in the the neck to hear, to learn of. Back to the so-called mystery, or to me, I think Canadians think about it. No political party decided to challenge Chrystia's little narrative. Bob Rae surrendered his, he left as a Liberal Party guy in Toronto, and she won the seat. And she had this story, which she told, I remember reading it. She told to Linda Diebel. Linda Diebel used to be on our show, by the way. But and when it became known, the media and the political so-called opposition never wanted to probe more closely and say, why are you dishonest in once saying that she represented him basically as kind of a liberal, Chomiak, and never respond to the question. Just speak of the facts, as Anne Charney says in your book. Let's just get to the facts. This is not a question of, I want revenge or I want to go to court. No. Could we just get the truth? And she will not to this day say a word. So Anne might ask you, I have my own theory, which is she does love her grandfather and she loves the organization.
Yes.
And she would never desert it because she wishes it to win.
Absolutely.
And that he be valorized and recognized for what he was, so she's not gonna give up on that. And by the way, the day that she would say, yes, my granddad was a Nazi collaborator, she'd be out of business in Edmonton. Is that possible?
I think the whole story kind of falls apart, because right now the Canadian government and the Canadian people through the media, they have internalized completely the nationalist story. And as you mentioned earlier, we have to be careful about talking about Ukraine, because there was the 2,000 Ukrainian Nazis we talk about, but there was 40,000 loyal Canadian Ukrainians who went to the war and fought against Hitler. And they fought loyally, and they were among the greatest fighters
in Canada. This group doesn't celebrate them.
And they just couldn't celebrate them because the organizations are controlled by this very small group of ultra-nationalists, of which Chrystia Freeland is one of them. Mm-hmm. It's important to make that distinction when you talk about. And I think in the book, I think I failed at some point. I didn't make the distinction well enough that the Ukrainians, but we talk about the Ukrainians and supporting the Nazis and involved in the Holocaust and that sort of thing, the Holocaust of bullets. That it was a small minority of Ukrainians, and the great majority of Ukrainians were on our side, both in Ukraine and in Canada.
Well, Himmler and his friends actually helped us understand it, right? Because they were going to call it the Ukrainian SS, and he says, no, it can't be called that. You have to call it Galicia.
That's right, yeah.
So
yeah.
Himmler basically named them, it was helpful in that they understood we're talking about Western Ukraine.
That's right. That has a different history.
And Eastern Ukraine, wish people would, if they want to see peace in Ukraine, please remember that it's not a simple country. The east of the country is very different than the west. And
absolutely,
people say, I'm a Ukrainian nationalist. I would say, up to which river?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Now you know the country fairly well then. Yeah, exactly right.
So it's It's very important. By the way, your book is going to be a big help. I'm so glad. It's titled Family Ties, and the subtitle, How a Ukrainian Nazi and a Living Witness Link Canada to Ukraine Today. The author is Peter McFarlane, and it is Lorimer, bless their hearts, that has published it. It is it's right up to June. I think you finished the book in June. So
right.
People should get their hands on it. I hope we can talk to you more about it, because I think we could also title it Everything You Wanted to Know About Chrystia Freeland's Grandpa Chomiak, But Were Afraid to Ask. And today, in the media, I guess I'd ask, let you comment too. The media, as Sheldon Kirshner pointed out in an editorial sometime, they've agreed to censor themselves. They won't ask big questions.
That's it. Yep.
And it's their duty. Why don't they just say, and again, as Ann Charney said, I'm not looking for anything but the truth. Why don't they just say, please, commit yourself one way or the other. Was he a collaborator, which we know he was, or not?
Yeah. That's it. Yeah, I think it's one of the areas that the media today is a bit of a mystery on versions of events that we get are kind of one-sided. It seems to be telling a narrative rather than telling a truth. So this Ukraine is very much that.
Yeah. Well, they need everything that you've written in this book. If anybody wants to understand it, they have to read the book. Peter McFarlane, thank you very much for being with us. I hope we always stay on this story, and we'd like to talk to you again sometime in the future.
For sure. Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure.
All right. Thank you.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Peter McFarlane, Family Ties, How a Ukrainian Nazi, that would be Michael Chomiak, and a living witness, who would be, by the way, Ann Charney, and she has a great book, which is a story of what happened to her family in that region where the Nazis had occupied Western Ukraine and annihilated the Jewish population. Her book is called Dobrid, and it did, by the way, the book did very well, and she is a highly respected author. It's just that, as you know, with time, we forget there's some books we had to go back and read. I'll tell you another one everybody should read is The White Guard by Bulgakov, the Russian author, who was there in that region at the end of World War I. It'll help you understand the truth about this place called Ukraine.